Hey, folks, welcome to the show. Before we get to my guests this week, February 23rd and 24th, Friday and Saturday, I am headlining at Gotham Comedy Club in New York City. Beautiful venue. I do it every year. Come on out. Have a great time. And it's February 23rd, 24th, Friday and Saturday. You can go to GothamComedyClub.com for tickets. So Domino's has this pizza insurance. So if you get carryout and you drop your pizza, they will replace it free if you have the insurance. So I got it. I got the insurance. Sure enough, I dropped my pizza. I brought it back and they replaced it. No hassle. It's amazing. With the deductible, the pizza only cost me $117. All right, my guest this week is James Altucher. Unbelievable story. He's an entrepreneur. He's made millions. He's lost millions, then made millions, then lost millions, then made millions and lost. I swear, three times. Got so depressed, seriously contemplated suicide and was about to try it. Then he kind of turned his life around. He's a hedge fund investor. He's a best-selling author. He's an expert on Bitcoins. And this guy has an amazing story. At one point, he completely divested himself of any possessions, his house, pictures, everything, stereo, TV, and kept 15 things that he was able to carry around in a small bag. You know, some shirts, some pants, toiletries, that's it. 15 things, and lived out of Airbnbs for 2 years because he just wanted to clean his life out. Just really, really amazing story. So I think you're going to really enjoy hearing what he has to say because it's nobody else has this story. All right, February 23rd, 24th. Hope to see you at Gotham Comedy Club and enjoy the interview. Hey, everybody. Welcome to the show. I am here in New York City. Just above Stand Up New York, great comedy club where I work. I'm here with James Altucher. I am an admirer of yours because there is about, I could probably do 4 minutes just about credits and things that you've done, but you're a best-selling author.
Yes.
Entrepreneur, a hedge fund manager, investor, and stand-up comedian. And you also invested in this club, which is pretty awesome.
Yeah, no, it's a great club. Glad that you're always performing here. And I can't believe I'm on your show. I feel like, does this put me on the same level as like Paul McCartney?
Absolutely.
Somehow?
You know what?
I feel like a Beatle now.
You know what? I'm going to go jetting with him later today and you're going to come with me. It's really fun to have you on because we've gotten to know each other over the last several months just from being around the club and then came to your birthday party, which was great. And just a great guy, but like, an amazing story and a lot of stuff I relate to, sadly, including the suicide of feelings, but we're going to get to that. You've done really amazing stuff in terms of, you know how to make money, you know how to lose money, but you know how to make money in many different ways. You have newsletters now that you put out. But I'm really interested in you as a person and the experiences that you've had in your life that you're using to sort of teach people how to live their life in a way to be happy, to improve themselves, whether it's intellectually, spiritually, physically. And you've said repeatedly in things that I've seen or heard you say that you do good for others and then, you know, things come from that. You started out, you know, making a lot of money and then losing it and then making a lot of money and then losing it. And you said something that I was really fascinated by. You said, I have ambition to have no ambition. What does that mean?
Well, think about it. When you wake up in the morning and you say, boy, I really hope today I get that job offer or right. Today I sell that business or today I get on that TV show. That's like a stressful feeling, right? It's like cortisol shoots to your head.
Right.
And there's only two ways to resolve it. There's one is to give up on your dream.
Right.
And because then the cortisol will go down. You don't have that stress anymore.
Right.
And the other way is to sort of push through it and to figure out, well, how can I get closer to getting on that show or making that money or getting that job or getting better at stand up? And I think the key is ambition. Ambition is the stress. And then I always want to say, okay, instead of having that stress, like, oh, I might fail or I might see, okay, what small steps can I take to improve? So now I no longer have the ambition to get on the TV show or to sell the company or whatever. I have I have very small steps that I'm going to use to make forward, or I'm going to give up. Again, either way,
right.
I remove the ambition from the equation.
You talk about improving like 1%, like just, and again, whether it's intellectually, I know you're a big believer in ideas and you have a pad and you're always writing down new ideas. That's hard. That would be hard for me. There are things that you've gone through that you've seemed to fix for yourself that I'd like to fix for myself.
So let's say, like, forgetting about the exact thing, like, let's say you have a problem with, I don't know, jealousy or anxiety about money or anxiety about why doesn't this person put me on at a club
right.
or why am I not on the TV show when that guy's on the TV show? So those are things that on the surface are not really solvable. So what I do is I try to take a step back and say, just kind of the obvious things, like, am I eating well today? If I'm eating more junk food than healthy food, I'm probably going to continue to be anxious about what I'm anxious about.
Right.
Because there's a million gazillion studies that show, okay, if you eat healthy foods, you're going to be less anxious than if you eat junk food. And you're going to be healthier. You're going to not be sick. You can't have energy if you're sick. You can't have energy to conquer your problems if you're sick. And so eating is an important part of that. So again, I'm sticking in the physical health category. Sleeping well, if you sleep 8 hours a day, reduces anxiety, gives you energy. If you do some amount of exercise, and I'm not talking about lifting weights, just like I live in a 6-floor apartment, I'll run up the stairs instead of taking an elevator.
Mm-hmm.
And that might be the main exercise I get for the day, but just a little bit, the 1% improvement.
Right.
Now with emotional health, okay, two people ask me to lunch, say, I'll say yes, and both put equal amounts of pressure. In fact, let's say the person who's more negative in my life puts more pressure on. That's why they're more negative in my life. I make sure I say yes to the person who's more positive for me and more uplifting and so on.
Because that's healthier for you.
Healthier for me, and it's the 1% improvement. And ultimately, it will be better for everyone. If I improve and have energy, it's going to make me do better in the world, have more ideas, and do more good things, which will help, hopefully, other people. Then there's creative health. So like you mentioned, keeping the pad around, writing down ideas every day, ideas to help me, ideas to help others, ideas to solve my problems or other people's problems. And then there's kind of what I call spiritual health, which is just recognizing at least a little bit every day, what am I grateful for and what things do I have no control over?
Right.
And just understanding that and respecting that. And really that's all it takes to solve the problem of thinking, why is that guy on the show and not me? So I can't kick that guy off the show because then I get into the politics. That's all a mess.
Right.
That's ugly and a mess.
Right.
You want to break it down into the simplest components that can improve you as a person. Because at the end of the day, when you die, whether it's today, tomorrow, or 50 years from now, you could say, I'm the best person I could be. You won't say, oh, I wish I was on that show.
I'm the best comedian that lived on the face of the planet or whatever. It took you a while to get to this place.
Yeah, because I was
always downs, right?
Yeah, I was always trying to get, money, for instance, as a start. Like, oh, I made all this money and then I lost it.
Which you did. You lost like 10, you made money on a company called Reset and you literally started designing websites. And I saw you say that you had to convince companies that they need a website.
Yeah, I had to convince like American Express that they had to do a website.
So hilarious.
Like this is like the very beginning. And
where do we need that? All that stuff. Come on.
Yeah. They all thought it was a fad. And B, we didn't really know if the web was going to be a commercial medium or a more artistic one.
Yeah.
So I was doing websites for a lot of entertainment companies that built into a fairly big company and we sold it. If I had been smarter about business then, I probably would have sold it for a lot more. Many of my competitors at the time sold for hundreds of millions. I didn't sell for anywhere near that, but I still sold enough money to have generational wealth. But since I knew so little about money, I just like blew it.
Yeah.
Like I just totally destroy. It's like I set that money on fire and just watched it disappear. And also, money doesn't make you happier, but it does magnify already what was inside of you. And I had no concept of money. And that having little knowledge of what money meant just became bigger and bigger so that I thought I was smart about money because I made it in one area. But in fact, I was really stupid about money, and I became more stupid as I got more.
You went to some great schools. You went to Cornell undergrad, and you talk about how you were a computer science major, but you didn't really learn a lot. And then you had to go take some additional classes when you finally got a job. And then, so where did you get the wherewithal and the ambition and the confidence to then turn around and say, I think you initially did it for HBO. I can design websites for major companies. There's something I think in a person internally, instinctively, that that makes you special if you can do that, given that you did not sound like you had a tremendous amount of confidence in computer science at the time.
I mean, the good thing is, this is what people didn't know in 1995, is that making websites wasn't rocket science. There was no real hard programming involved. Like, it's probably hard to program, I don't know, a rocket to go to Mars, but it wasn't hard to make a website. But nobody knew how to do it. Nobody had the skill set then.
Right.
And so HBO wanted to make a website. And I had a secret plan. So I was working in the technology department of HBO, but my secret plan was to make a TV show for HBO. And so
create an idea and run the show and be a producer on the show, maybe be in the show. Yeah.
I had zero interest in computer science or technology or
anything. This sounds like me. We talked about this on your podcast.
Yeah.
I was a lawyer, but I was writing jokes on the side. Yeah.
But it was a very parallel story. And it's often through some backdoor method that you get to where you want to go. So at the same time, my brother-in-law had a business making CD-ROMs, which don't even exist then.
Right.
So I told him, you're going to go out of business. I'll show you this new thing called the internet and the web. The internet wasn't new, but the web was. And he was a designer. I showed him. And then I pitched to HBO, you guys need a website.
Mm-hmm.
So they said, sure, you pitched this to us, you do it. It became my job as an employee of HBO to do it. So I hired my brother-in-law to do HBO's website. And then I essentially took over his company. So it sounds unethical, which maybe it is. It's a gray area.
It's corporate America. Come on.
It's corporate America. Right. It's not like.
It's gray areas.
Yeah. It's a gray area. And so essentially I hired myself to do HBO's website. But that meant also I was hiring my brother-in-law. I was hiring his employees and so on. And I really did think they were the best for the job. And there was a little bit, the unethical part is that I had a overlapping, I owned most of his company at the same time. So I was biased, but I also knew I would do the best job.
Right.
And then I would do the best job as an employee of HBO, and I would do the best job for my brother-in-law and his company, which became my company.
Mm.
And so we did that website, did a great job. Other entertainment companies started calling us. Banks started calling us. We did Con Edison, American Express. We did all sorts of websites. We did every gangster rap record label website.
Yeah, I was blown away by that.
Yeah, we did like Bad Boy Records.
Yeah.
We did Loud Records, which was
Def
the Wu-Tang
Jam,
Clan.
Right?
We did Jive. We did all of Interscope stuff. Then we did Miramax.com.
How does a guy like you, who looks like you, go into their offices and get the business as opposed to a guy who looks like, a rapper or something like that?
Well, two reasons. One is,
I don't mean that as an insult. I'm just saying.
Yeah, no, but it's not an insult. Two reasons. One is, all at the time, at least, all those companies were run by Jews. So,
Jimmy Iovine, right?
So he was Interscope.
Right.
So Steve Stout, who worked for him, I reported to when I did it.
So Jew on Jew, I get it. Yeah.
So, and then there was a guy, Steve Rimlin, who worked for Steve Stout, who was very Jewish. And I worked with him. And Loud Records, which was the Wu-Tang Clan, was run by Steve Rifkin. And Steve Rifkin's dad, Jules Rifkin, ran Spring Records in the 50s, which was James Brown and all that. The Sopranos had a character based on Jules Rifkin. And it was this whole, I hate to use the term Jewish mafia thing, but you walk into Loud Records and these big, huge Jewish guys, which just sounds like an oxymoron, but it's true. They would like pat me down to see if I had a gun on me or anything. And then I'd go in and hang out with
Steve. They really Rifkin. Patted you down?
Yeah, yeah. And
you hide it in your hair? You're a Jew fro there?
I don't know what they were looking for, but then I would hang out at with Steve Rifkin and his brother Jonathan. And we'd make the websites for the Wu-Tang Clan and their other artists. And we would do, you know, on their CDs or DVDs, there was something called an enhanced CD. We'd make games and stuff for their CDs. But we built up to be a pretty nice sized company in the space. The internet got hot. We got acquired.
So you've left HBO at this point.
Well, no, I stayed at HBO. Literally, I was in my lunch break running across town to pitch like Loud Records.
You were doing the exact same thing I was doing. But
And it was scary because I didn't want anyone to know. Like that, you know, because people would say, hey, we want you to be devoted full time to this. I'm like, absolutely. Then I'd run back to HBO to program some little thing on HBO's schedule. And
was this part of a dream or a vision for yourself that you wanted to be an entrepreneur and have your own because I know you say, and you've said repeatedly, like, you know, and you have a best-selling book, Choose Yourself, like, no one should have control over your life other than you. So was this a plotted out thing, or was this just coming out of you and I'm going to ride this wave and see where it goes?
I think at the time it was just coming out of me for this reason. One is, you can't just say to yourself, I want to do a TV show. Because like in that business, for instance, there are so many gatekeepers.
Yeah.
There's like the production, you know, there's like the assistant producers, then there's the executive producers, then there's the company, then there's the who's going to be the director and whether he likes you. And that's just one little example. Like in other examples, there might be agents and managers in the middle, and then there might be other production companies in the middle. It's a very hard industry to get through all the layers of gatekeepers.
Right.
So I was trying to find desperately a back door. And so now, I was in charge of HBO's website, I pitched to Jeff Bukas, who was then the CEO of HBO. Now he's the CEO of Time Warner.
Jesus,
I said to him,
that's a good guy to pitch to.
Yeah. I said to him, why don't we do an original, HBO's great at original TV shows.
Yeah.
Why don't we do an original web show? So he said, you do whatever you want. And I started doing an original web show that had an HBO flavor to it. Mm-hmm. And then Sheila and Evans, who we had on the podcast a couple of months ago, She liked it, and she said, why don't we do this as a TV show? So suddenly now I've totally gotten in through the back door.
That was the one you were going around New York City at like 3 a.m.
Yeah, interviewing people at 3 a.m. And I shot it as a pilot, but they never aired it. There was a lot of reasons. And again, a lot of politics. And I had pitched several other shows that got kind of stuck in the politics. And I said, you know what? This doesn't feel good, me being dependent on one or two people to make a decision on my dreams. I don't want one person who I don't really know that well to decide yes or no about my dreams and whether they're allowed to come true.
Right.
So I did leave HBO in part because they had also by this time realized what I was doing. And, you know, even though it was good for them, everything, they said the best thing is to just clean this up and you leave and whatever. And we were big enough then, my company, for me to take over full time.
Mm.
So then I left, joined my company full time, and now I was an entrepreneur.
How did that feel? Were you afraid? Were you excited? Was it...
I was scared to death. The first day, I remember I called Loud Records and I said, okay, we're ready to start on all of the Wu-Tang Clan's websites for all of them. And the guy, every music label is crazy. So they had promised previously we were going to do this. It would have been a huge deal. And this is the first day I'm at being CEO of my own company full time. And the guy at Loud Records was like, nah, you don't want to do that. Like, forget that one. And so that was going to be our biggest client. And I literally...
It's like breaking up with a girl because the other girl said she'd go out with you. And then it's like... But I just broke up with the girl. What?
Which has happened to me also. but this time it happened to me. I literally, like, I went to lunch and I just was like crying in the pizza place next door. And I'm like, what did I do? And then all my HBO friends took me out to dinner that night to celebrate me going to my company. And I was just like crying at this dinner because...
Can I have my job back?
I kind of was feeling like that. But at the same time, once you leave, you can't really think in your head, oh, now I'm going to go back. It like feels really bad.
Yeah.
And so... I did whatever I could to make it work. Like, and I was just on the street doing deal after deal after deal to make it work. But I didn't enjoy it at all. So I was as fast as I possibly could. It took a year from beginning. I was very good at sales. So I got us a lot of business. We grew really fast. And then...
Why do you think you're good at sales?
I think...
I mean, I believe you are, but what do you, objectively, if you can look at yourself, like, what do you...
I think it reminds me of stand-up comedy. So tell me if you think this analogy works mm-hmm. correctly, is that you have, when you do a sale, you have this basic skeleton. So in this case, my skeleton was, I know how to do make a website better than anyone else. Here's all the ones we did, and here's my ideas for you. So I prepare for a meeting, here's my ideas for you. But that's the skeleton. And then the full body of a sale has the skeleton in the middle, but then it's more your personal connection with the person to whom you're selling. So in comedy, you have the skeleton, which is your jokes, like your just sheer jokes.
Yeah.
But if that's all you had, you won't
and
succeed.
And no personality, if you're not connecting, if you're not warm, whatever.
Yeah, if you're not connecting, if you're not instantly realizing how the audience is changing on you, if you're not instantly realizing what words and what people you need to kind of make on your side.
Right.
So ultimately, what we were really in the business of, and this might apply somehow to comedy, what we're really in the business of was not just selling website, but was I was essentially selling myself as a friend to the clients. So what they really wanted was a friend.
Right.
And because there was a lot of companies pitching them. They wanted someone who they could say, check the box, this guy knows how to make websites. What they really wanted was someone they could call at like 10 o'clock at night and saying, I'm having this problem at my job.
Yeah.
What should I do?
Yeah.
So I was selling them my friendship and they would hire me. And we very quickly got, you know, dozens of clients and got big. And then I was cultivating relationships at the same time with all the people doing acquisitions in the space. Because I just wanted to sell a company. I hated being an entrepreneur. I hated selling my friendship. It felt like prostitution.
And they would literally just call you for business advice in general, not regarding
or relationship advice or career advice. Yeah, because I was there for
them. Smart, trusting guy. They felt that you were on the up and up, a real deal that they could, that's amazing.
Yeah. And then, and you know, and sometimes you do a good job on the website. Sometimes you don't. So I was also getting the calls like, hey, you need to come in here Monday morning. We need to have a talk.
Yeah.
And those were always scary. So I didn't enjoy, and then, you know, employees are always having sex with each other or whatever. So you have to kind of like manage that. And, you know, in general, it's very difficult to be an entrepreneur.
And how old were you at the time? Late 20s?
28, 29.
Yeah, that's a lot.
Let's see, 1990. I started the company when I was 27 and then left for full time when I was 26 or 27. 28 or 29 28 or 29 and then sold it when I was 30. So from beginning to end, from when I was full-time on it, I mean, we've been building it for years. When I was full-time on it to when we sold it was exactly 365 days because that was my one thing.
And you sold it for $10 million, right?
Yeah, maybe like 15 because we sold for stock and the stock had been going up because it was the internet boom.
Right. What did you think, if you hated being an entrepreneur, did you have something, an idea in your head of what you think you wanted to do at that point once you sold it, other than burn through all the money?
Well, it's weird. Like at the time, when the beginning of it, I thought I'm going to make some money and then I'm going to take a couple of years off and I'm going to write a novel. And that's what I wanted to do. That's what I'd wanted to do for 10 years.
Yeah.
I wanted to write a novel or do a TV show.
Yeah.
So I figured I'd get back to that. But once you had this money, this is the stupidest thing in the world. I honestly thought in my brain, which was stupid. I will admit it over and over again. I was like I had an IQ of zero or negative. I honestly thought at this point I was the poorest financially I had ever been in my life, which doesn't make any sense at all.
Wait, this is before you actually
after I sold the company. After I sold the company, when I had the money.
Because there is a point when you, I think it was after the second time you made a lot of money and lost that you checked your ATM one day and there was $143 in there.
Actually, it was with this one that I thought like, okay, I need to get $100 million in order to actually be rich, which was so stupid. Meanwhile,
is that society just what we do in this country?
And it was like suddenly at that time, like I didn't know anything. I was from HBO. I was a programmer, and I wanted to write a novel. So all these people from all these investment banks, including Credit Suisse First Boston, where you were from at that time, like you were working there at that time. All these people from Credit Suisse were like inviting me to parties, and like I'd go to the party, and I was just in scruffy clothes and everything because I was an internet guy. And people would be whispering, that's Mark's internet friend. And then they would corner me and like try to ask me about
stocks.
Right,
and you probably looked, right out of Central Casting, exactly what a Wall Street guy wants you to look like.
Yeah.
Who's a tech guy. If you looked completely put together and not like a tech guy, they probably wouldn't have given you their money or wanted to give you their money.
No, if I was wearing like a suit or something, they probably would have figured, oh, well, he's like a banker.
Can you mess your hair up a little bit and whatever?
Like I was like totally the internet guy and everybody would look to me around the table like for the ideas for the next business.
Right.
So I came up with an idea for another business, which is, and this was literally my pitch, and this is the environment at the time. I said, first there was internet and then there's going to be wireless internet. So that was my whole pitch. I remember one time I had a phone call and Mark Patterson at your old company set up the phone call. It was Henry Kravis on the call, you know, KKR, Henry Kravis,
Jim
McCann, 1-800-Flowers, Leo Hendry, who was at AT&T at the time, but then did all sorts of other stuff. And then some guy, Dennis O'Brien from Irish Telecom or whatever. And that was my entire pitch.
Jeez.
We raised $20 million on that call.
Come on.
No, I'm serious. And we had to scale it back because we didn't want so many people from that one call. We ended up raising from CMGI, Allen Company, everything. Then, I'm sure you know these companies, Investcorp, Apollo, all these other places wanted me to start a VC fund. So I started a venture capital fund. So I thought, okay, I'm on my way. I started a new company. Right. I started a venture capital fund. One way or the other, I'm going to have $100 million. And then, of course, I totally blew everything. Like
you bought things.
I bought houses. I made huge investments in the worst companies, like very inappropriately sized investments. Like now I know how to invest. Then I didn't know how to invest at all. And so just almost as quickly as I made it, I lost it. Like that amount of money, like $50 million.
How, I mean, what's amazing to me is you said a quote, what did I, someone asked you a question, what did I learn too late in life? And you said nothing. In other words, you say, there's a piece in Forbes about you, learn, write, teach, learn, write, apply. So you don't get, you get knocked down, but you seem to get up after these situations. Now, I know you got very, very depressed and you were suicidal and really thought about suicide.
But- because it's not like you get knocked down and you say, oh, yay, Now I'm knocked down so I could succeed.
Right.
Like you think, oh no, I'm knocked down. I'm down and out. I had won the lottery because it was the internet boom.
I'm never going to come up with another good idea that's going to make that kind of money.
I wasn't like a real professional moneymaker. I wasn't a Wall Street guy at all.
So how did you pick yourself up and let yourself even put one foot in front of the other? Because you literally, didn't you go to like a beach and walked in the water and thought about killing yourself?
Yeah, it was horrible. I mean, there was lots of ways I thought about killing myself.
I think, by the way, I saw you have a conversation about this. I think sleeping pills, you said in one interview, there's no good way to kill yourself. I think sleep, if I did it, because I, you know, I think of, not a lot, but suicide pills, like sleeping pills.
I think there's always the danger that you could wake up with brain damage and a stroke.
Oh, right.
But there's lethal doses of like, I won't say the pills here, but there's lethal doses of quite a few pills out there.
And you were Googling on a regular basis.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I knew how to do it. And because I was trying to think, how could I do it without hurting myself? And how can I do it so that my life insurance policy pays off? Because I got my life insurance policy when I had a lot of money. And then
sure
I had zero. So, I mean, I was down to zero and I wanted my kids to have money and they weren't old enough to even remember who I was. So I figured, okay, but I just had to do this the right way.
Now, why didn't you do it? And what was there that moment where you were very close? What was that moment like if you were very close? And then why didn't you do it?
I think, you know, there gets a point also where you're so depressed and so anxious, you can't do it. Like you're too depressed.
Yeah, you had somebody writing a newsletter for you for a little while.
Yeah, like there was one point I was down and out for like 6 months.
So
and my, I always kind of have like a silent business partner on a lot of my deals. And he literally was writing my byline. And this is like in 2006, it was several years. It was after my next business. But he was basically writing all my articles for me. They were all about finance and stuff. And he knew as much about finance as me. But he would just take my formula of writing those types of articles and he would write four a day, which is what I was doing.
Wow.
And I was down for the count because I was also going through a divorce then and a failed business. And
why do you think your marriage failed?
I think, you know, when you're so driven by something so small as money, and I understand money is very important. Like without money, you can't pay the bills and you can't raise your kids and all this stuff. Money's really important. But if that's your only money should really just be a side effect of being valuable at what you love doing. That's the ideal.
Right.
But getting close to that ideal is
It's time consuming, and it takes a lot out of you, and it takes all your focus.
Yeah, and just being worried about money is hard then to make money, because you're not building up any skills. You're not building value for yourself. You want to build value for others, and you want to build networks, you want to build connections, and you want to have a motivating vision that's a little bit more advanced than everyone else's vision of the world, because then if you execute on that vision, you can make a lot of money. And then money is a side effect of all of these things, you know, plus having good relationships, plus keeping healthy so you have energy, all the stuff we talked about earlier. But, you know, now at this point, if you even Google, I want to die, I'm like the number two. There's 401 million results come up, but I'm number one. I'm number two or number three. I used to be number one, but Google manually changed it to be the National Suicide Hotline instead of me.
Well, this is what's so fascinating about you is, you know, people have called you a guru. You don't call yourself a guru, and I don't either.
Should call me a guru.
And Brian Rashid, I don't know if I'm pronouncing that correctly, wrote a Forbes article on you. And in it, this is a quote from Brian Koppelman, creator of Showtime's Billions. James is on a very personal journey, allowing his readers and listeners to experience it in real time. He's telling you the story on Saturday. On Sunday, he's talking about how it failed. And on Monday, he's talking about doing it a different way. How hard was it to start to admit so publicly to your failures? And it seems cathartic for you to do what you do the way you do it, not just for you, but for others.
Yeah, like there was a point in 2010 where I had, which is fine, we're skipping through another business, another failure. There's a point in 2010 where I had a little bit of money, but not enough to live forever on, not even enough to live a couple years on, but I had no job, no prospects, no ideas, and I was just, what am I going to do? And I was just frustrated and depressed, and so I just started writing these articles, just being honest. Like, you look at CNBC, everyone's in their suits and ties and giving their opinions about the markets. They're all a bunch of failures or they're just talking their way to make the most amount of money off of their media appearance.
Right.
And I decided to stop doing all of that and just, I moved 60 miles north of the city and I just started writing, like, I failed and then this is what happened. And I would talk about the worst failure, the worst feelings I had, and then the ways in which I personally tried to bounce back each time, whether they worked or not. This is not advice, hence the no guru thing. This is not advice. This is just what I did. So other people could either pay attention or not. But that suddenly built up this huge audience unexpectedly. I lost my entire finance audience, but then I built this much bigger audience of people who were writing, like you often get messages on your website, people writing like, this is my exact situation.
Right.
What do I do? And it built up a much, you know, different kind of career for me.
Why did these failures, if you want to call them, keep happening? You make a lot of money, you lose it. I get it the first time around. You don't have your act together. You're still young. You're spending money that you shouldn't. You're investing in bad investments. Then you do it again. And then there's a third time, right?
Yeah. By this time, I'm like 41, 42 years old.
So what happened the second time that you went in the hole? And why did the third time happen? Are they different reasons each time?
No, I think it's the exact same reasons. I think I wasn't taking care of my core self.
I saw you say that. What does that mean?
I think
core integrity, you said, was when you used the phrase having core integrity, and that's when things started to turn around for you.
Yeah, I think I wasn't being honest about who was good for me and who wasn't. Like, if you're around 10 people, I remember one time we had this astronaut on my podcast, Mike Massimino, and he couldn't get into NASA. He kept trying to apply to NASA. He couldn't get in. So finally, he goes off to MIT to study robotic arms. And he mentioned to me just on the side, like, oh, out of the 10 people in my class, 4 of them ended up in going into outer space, you know, becoming astronauts. But if he had just said, oh, I just started hanging out in bars in Boston, right, he would never have been able to say, out of the 4 people sitting around this bar, or out of the 10 people sitting around this bar, 4 of them are going to end up in outer space.
Right.
So it really is the people you are around. And even one negative person will bring you all the way down.
And you talk about this as well, like sort of when you sort of had this turnaround, choosing yourself, focusing on a healthier way to live emotionally, intellectually, physically, the emotional part being surrounding, you were surrounded by what you call bad people.
Yeah.
That's your quote. What is the definition of it? Is just somebody who's negative that keeps telling you you can't do it?
No.
Or somebody who's drugging a lot?
Well, it could be all of the above. So yes, people who were telling me I can't do it, and B, people who didn't have my best interest at heart. So they would say, let's do a deal. But then you'd look at the deal and it was all in favor of them and not in favor of you.
Right.
And you could never convince them otherwise, but there'd be greed factors to say, oh, maybe I should do this deal with them because maybe there really is money there. And it just never, ever, 0% chance.
And it's also a miserable way to live, because if you're like me, then you're like, I know I'm getting screwed. Should I say something? I know this person. Like, then you start sort of going through your own mind, like what you can, how to make this work and still have the person be your friend and like you and all of that.
Right. And so that's where core integrity comes in, where you have to be able to say immediately, I'm feeling funny about this. I don't know why, but it's not working for me. So we can either work this out or not. Either way, I'm fine. And that kind of honesty, when you feel it right there in your body, is really important. And then the other thing I started really focusing on was creativity. Again, coming up with 10 ideas a day.
Yeah, I just want to interrupt you there. Here's one that I saw. 10 things I value more than money. You wrote this. You write these on. Do you still write them on server checks? Wait.
Yeah.
So funny. 1, community. 2, creativity. 3, curiosity. 4, giving. 5, melancholy. Helping, laughter, learning, freedom, kissing. Why melancholy? What do you mean by that?
I think it's when I... So there was one period where I threw out... I wanted to try a different lifestyle.
Yeah, I love this.
So I threw out all of my belongings,
including
except for
pictures.
One bag. All my photos of me, my parents, my kids.
It was an 18-wheeler. It took a week, right? You said?
Yeah. It was an 18-wheeler. It was like a friend of mine. I didn't want to be a part of it. So I hired a friend of mine to do it. And I told her either give everything away, keep anything for yourself, sell anything, or throw anything out. That was just useless.
I can't believe you didn't keep pictures.
I didn't keep anything because I needed to fit everything. I'll show you. I needed to fit everything in this bag.
But why would pictures, what was the detriment to you emotionally at that point if you kept pictures?
Well, a lot of pictures were in photo albums, like pictures of me as a kid or pictures of my parents or whatever. You know, some pictures you have online, but it was the physical pictures. Mm. But I didn't take any time to digitize anything. Like, it was just a one day decision to my friend, just go here and clean everything out. End this lease. I ended a lease I had in the city as well. And I just moved around from Airbnb to Airbnb.
And he does have a fairly medium-sized bag that you could fit about a couple pairs of pants, a couple of shirts.
Yeah, 2 outfits, a computer, and a phone. And then in the Airbnbs, there would be all the furniture, towels, sheets, stuff like that.
And is this after the third major failure?
I would say by then... maybe 4th or 5th. I had a lot.
So why did you, what was the light bulb that went off that said, I need to do this? And what did you think this was going to achieve for you by ridding yourself of all of these things? Because I you have said your life was so complicated at that point. There were so many things to keep up with.
I felt like I needed to clean house to kind of start from scratch with this physical, emotional, creative, spiritual.
Right.
Just to kind of, I don't know, I felt this overwhelming need to clean up. And it wasn't necessarily a good thing or a bad thing, meaning I missed the things I threw out. And so that's why I put melancholy on there. People always say, oh, it must have felt so freeing. You must have been so happy. No, a lot of times I wasn't quite sad, but melancholy is not necessarily a bad thing. Like, it's often a pleasant feeling, like, oh, I realized there were these things I valued in my personal space. Mm. And so gradually, maybe because of that melancholy, I realized, oh, I need to grow now from the roots up my own personal space and fill it up again from emptiness. Not fill it up with too many things, because I learned a lot about minimalism by living this way. Like, I'm very conscious of everything I buy and spend money on. It was very important to me. But kind of a feeling of melancholy was a big driving force. I'll tell you something about this particular list. Mm. I'm glad I took a picture of this one because one time I was at a party, and party was actually of a very famous person who's been portrayed in movies and so on. And she didn't know me. I didn't know her. We just had a mutual friend. But anyway, my waiter's pad had fallen out of my pocket, and that was on the top. And she picked it up and was looking at it, and she came to me and said, did you write this? And I said, yeah. And she said, this is my 50th birthday party. Can you please give me this list as a gift? Mm. So I gave her that list.
That's
great. Fortunately, I had taken a photo of it beforehand.
I think it's very telling. It's a sign that someone's in a good place when the first thing on a list of 10 things I value more than money is community.
Yeah, because community, again, is about having good people in your life that care about you.
But I also feel like that person, you, is someone that wants to contribute and give to community. It's not just surrounding yourself for yourself around with good people.
Right, well, look at stand-up comedy. Like, as you know, when you begin stand-up comedy, if you have any one particular goal, that goal is going to be smashed instantly.
Yeah.
Meaning you're not going to get it, or it's going to take you much longer than you thought. And so a little over a year ago now, I got obsessed with stand-up comedy.
And why are you doing it now?
I have no idea. I've always been a fan of it. Like, we talked on my podcast about 20 years ago, going to the Luna Lounge on Ludlow Street. Like, I worked in HBO for a while in their comedy department. And I just always loved it, but I was always afraid to go on stage. And then, even though I was a public speaker for 20 years, I've been a writer, I've been a performer of sorts for many years.
Yeah.
But comedy, I don't know. There was something about it. It was just scary. And then finally, I started going up. I became obsessed, started going up 3 to 6 times a week, not only at this club, but other clubs and so on. And then I decided to use my business skills a little bit. So I bought into this particular club where we're recording the podcast. And then I couldn't find an Airbnb in this area because New York City's been cracking down on illegal Airbnbs. And nobody in the Upper West Side is a very family-oriented neighborhood. There was just no Airbnbs available. Mm-hmm. So, and a friend of mine called me, and she said, listen, rent a place now. You did it for a couple of years and now you're about to turn 50 and it's kind of creepy. No woman is going to want to go out with you. So,
hey, could you help me move and then I'll take you out to dinner and we could start a relationship?
Basically,
but you've said, I'm quoting you, in those 2 years when you were a nomadic, if you will, I was more successful than I ever was. And another quote of yours is, from nothing comes everything. How were you more successful, and how does everything come from nothing?
Well, because I kind of cleaned out my environment in every way, and I had to figure out, okay, how do I restart? I became very focused on, okay, I'm going to be creative every day. I'm going to come up with ideas for businesses. I'm going to come up with ideas for other people to make businesses. I'm going to come up with ideas to make money. I'm going to come up with ideas to write books.
And then you can execute and you can really focus because you're not spending a half hour worrying about paying your mortgage or that the pipe burst in your basement or that you got to go get new tires put on your car. And you're singularly focused on these creative ideas.
And because I had community, I wasn't going out there, you know, looking for new friends or looking for a girlfriend because I was trying to work on my spiritual health, I was not trying to be anxious. I was normally a very anxious person. And then people always say ideas are nothing, execution's everything, but execution ideas became part of my idea. So if I had an idea I liked, I would say, okay, here's 10 ideas for the first steps to execute on something. And then I would send them to a friend of mine who was starting a business as an example. And he would say, these are great ideas. We're going to do them. How about we give you advisor shares of this company? How about we give you advisor shares of this other company? Hmm. How about we let you invest at a valuation that the founders invested at? And so I'm not a very good entrepreneur, I realized, but I'm a good investor when it's with connections that I have in my network and where I'm contributing ideas and they like them. So they respect the value I bring to the table. And so I get good deals that way. Mm. And that became kind of a good way for me to make money.
You know, unfortunately we got to wrap, but you got to come on again because there's a whole lot of other stuff we got to talk about.
Definitely.
And I feel like you're a Jewish version of me. And with much better
and hair. Next time let's talk more about comedy because the nuts and bolts of comedy I always want to hear about.
I just think that you're a very important person for people to know.
Oh, thank you very much, Paul. I feel the same way about you. So good you're doing this podcast.
Yeah, and it's not just because I think you're a guy that knows about Bitcoin and can make a lot of people money, but more important than all of that is that people can relate to somebody who's had some real downs and then figured out how to take that and make it positive out of it, not just for himself, but for others. I think that's a really, really, it's a calling. And I think you really, people need to know about you.
Thanks so much. Yeah, and I'm happy to come back on. And thanks
absolutely.
Again.
All right. That's James Altucher. And we will have him back again. I'm me, the guy who hosts this thing. And thanks for checking out the show this week. And we will see you next week. All right. How great is this guy's story? James is amazing. He's got a podcast that I'm on, the James Altucher Show. And please come see me if you can, February 23rd and 24th at Gotham Comedy Club. Go to gothamcomedyclub.com for tickets. And we will see you next week.